You're listening to In the Moment on STPB News. I'm CJ Keene, coming to you from nearly a mile underground at the Sanford Underground Research Facility. I have two people with us here who are absolutely critical in the operations of this facility, Mike Headley and Wendy Straub. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you. Happy Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here. It's always a very special experience getting able to come down here. So I guess since most people will never get to see it, how would you describe what it's like once you're actually this far below the surface?
Well, actually, we're in finished lab space where we're performing physics experiments today and have been for a number of years. And other than having no windows to look outside, it looks like any other lab that you'd see on the surface. But the trip from the surface down to the 4850 level, you're in a cage that was used, same thing that was used during the mining days when Homestake was operating here, and very much a mining environment, kind of wet, kind of dirty. But it's really interesting the transition from that environment to, you know, one of the cleanest spots on the planet to do all this research.
Yeah, I don't know if people will ever be able to see the booties that we're wearing on our feet, but the dust sensitivity is very real, at least in this particular corner of the space.
It is, yeah.
So I hate to ask you such a big question to start off, but what's new underground?
It's been an interesting year, to say the least, and most recently we had a huge milestone. We've been working to build the Long Baseline Neutrino Facility Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, kind of a mouthful, but trying to study neutrinos to figure out what happened at the earliest stages of the universe. And so for the last 5 years, we spent three of those excavating big caverns, 2 years putting all the utilities and everything in them. And then just a few weeks ago, we transitioned to actually building the Dune experiment, which is a huge milestone. We had the experiment includes incredibly long and heavy beams, and we had this huge event that included the Undersecretary for Science, Dario Gil, and we had dignitaries from all over the world and also the general public. They got to sign their name on one of the beams that will be part of the experiment for decades to come. And so that was a huge milestone. And so Wendy, our chief operating officer, and her staff are now in the process of moving what's roughly 10 million pounds of steel underground over the next few months to actually start building the experiment.
Now, moving that amount of steel, it absolutely has to be a logistical challenge, first of all, but also it's not the biggest elevator shaft in the world. How do you do it?
So anything that doesn't fit on the conveyance will be broken apart and slung underneath the conveyance and then reassembled underground. For the long beams that Mike spoke of, there's actually a special conveyance that is in the place of the skip, which is essentially a large bucket that would have hauled ore out of the underground, is now a special conveyance that is 60 feet in length that is made for the beams so that they can be secured within the conveyance and hauled underground. So this past weekend, the team safely transported 10 beams to the 4850-foot level. So it's definitely an engineering feat. There is a lot of planning, a lot of paperwork, and some trial and error that's involved with transporting beams. But we are ready for the task.
One of the things that really struck me when I toured the caverns themselves, they're huge, but also the thought of having to break everything down, and especially like, you know, a big crane or whatever it is that you're using to, you know, build these supports, you can understand why the work being done down here in the construction department is doing very, very well.
Yeah, and I should mention, Mike said that, you know, Tyson Mining completed the excavations of the large caverns. And we actually were awarded Large Project of the Year by the Underground Construction Association. So Fermilab and the subcontractors, which includes SDSDA. And the work that was involved with that was, as you can imagine, quite complex. And we should mention that the Ross Shaft crew completed over 500 slung loads safely and successfully. So a lot of that work that was done and supported by South Dakota Science and Technology Authority staff.
Maybe a good analogy. One thing that we like to try and say to communicate the taking of all these things from the surface and underground and back out, I mean, it's like building a ship in a bottle where the neck of the bottle is a mile long, is literally what it's all about.
So when you're going up to such a massive undertaking, no pun intended, but this is a huge project, I guess, how do you even begin to begin something like that? What's the thought process like when you're just in the very genesis of that plan?
We have, and our partners who are working on this project, have an incredibly complex and detailed planning process. And so we start, you know, you figure out how the project's going to get built from a big picture perspective, but literally everything we do has work instructions with it, and a lot of these jobs are one-offs. So you have to sit down and you have to figure out what the work instructions are. But we put a lot of effort into work planning, and what comes out of that is, you know, we have a great plan to actually do a job, so we have a great certainty that we can do it without having an incident or someone getting hurt.
And once that plan's in motion, what are we expecting to see as we continue to get these steel beams into our underground lab?
I think you're going to see the successful completion of the cryostats. The cryostats are, for lack of a better term, a large Yeti cooler that will house a lot of liquid argon needed to host the experiment. And I think that you'll see that happen in the very near future.
A large Yeti cooler, I like that. So this is really
That's Mike's term. I stole it from him.
This is going to be seriously cold.
Very cold. Yeah, the argon will be 300 degrees below zero Fahrenheit.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's, with each detector, we'll have two detectors to start with. Each one will have roughly 3 million gallons of liquid argon in it. It will take, you know, after a couple of years of the construction of the cryostat and putting the detector elements in it, it will take a year to fill that, each one of those, with argon.
So looking forward, beyond just this one project, what else can we expect to hear from when it comes to SURF?
We continue to have the world's most sensitive dark matter experiment, exactly just, you know, about 50 feet in the other direction from where we're sitting. And they're making great progress and hoping to hear a new set of results from the LZ experiment before too long. And they'll continue. We expect them to continue to be the world's leader in trying to find this elusive stuff called dark matter.
I didn't know you were a juggler. How do you manage having such, I don't want to say divergent, but very different projects from one another, yet they're all scientific in nature, but they're all so unique. How do you manage that, you know, making that happen?
It's evolved over time. I mean, we're approaching being in operations here for 20 years, and we've got a number of people, myself. I mean, a month from now, I'd be here for 18 years. And over the years, we've really developed a strong process that helps us in being able to support these diverse groups. Like we talked about the Dune experiment, 1,500 scientists, all sorts of contractors who are working on that. The contrast to that is we also support biology groups where they may bring two people out here. And so our kind of going back to how we plan work and everything, it helps us try and organize all the work that needs to get completed. And so we are kind of a juggling act. I mean, we're really trying to balance a lot of different things and make sure everyone can get where they need to go and do their work safely so they can get their science done. That's really our job.
And actually quite the breakthrough in the biology department, if I remember correctly, that was connected to here. I don't know, just speak to what the uniqueness of the environment that SURF kind of harbors and how that can create very interesting results in when it comes to biology.
Yeah, there's some really interesting organisms that have been discovered here over time. We've got rock that's under great pressure, and as you get lower with a lot of heat, and you may be referring to some of the work the School of Mines has done. I know they've got some research that looks very promising for being able to sequester carbon within rock, which is really kind of a mind-blowing thing to think about being able to do. And then they've also got some great advances in the medical arena as well.
When it comes to all the work that SURF is doing, obviously it needs support. So when it comes to the funding question, how can not only South Dakotans support their underground lab, but also how can we make sure that SURF is able to continue the work that it's doing?
There's a lot of work that goes into, and that's something that I do a lot of, is working with our delegation and other members of Congress to help communicate, not only kind of the nuts and bolts operations work, but the value of the science and what you know, we can look back over decades of physics research that's similar to what we're doing, and a lot of amazing applications have come from that, like the MRI and all sorts of medical imaging technology. And so our delegation has been really just amazing supporters. They understand the value of this from a scientific perspective and the impact on the world. The economic impact that SURF is having in South Dakota, which is $2 billion in this decade alone. And we do a lot of work with K-12 STEM education as well, and working with over 22,000 students per year here in the state. So a lot of amazing impacts that really enables us to go on the Hill and have an amazing story to tell in working to get funding.
So for both of you guys, it's been a year since we last spoke in this very hallway right here. When you look back on that year and you look at what has been accomplished in this space, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud that we've done it safely. We have an incredible team of operations staff, engineers, and supporting individuals that help us out. And I'm most proud of the fact that we've done it safely and we've accomplished a lot.
Yeah. A year and a half ago, we completed a period of over 1 million hours of work without any sort of lost time injury. And I think now we're over 500,000 hours again. So, you know, when we started years ago, our ability and our process to be able to plan and do it in a way that we really felt good about the safety of going into a job, it was really kind of a little wild back in the day. And so it's really grown to where, you know, maybe a good analogy would be, we think of the U.S. National Labs, the 17 U.S. National Labs, and how they do this amazing cutting edge work and they do it so safely. And really the processes and the way we do work here is really on par, and in some cases better. We have experts from other labs come in and review us and give us feedback. And in a lot of cases, they're saying, hey, the work that you're doing is better than what we've seen at the lab that I came from.
So to your point, we'll make sure that we keep all these cables off the ground before we pack up and leave.
No tripping hazards.
Can't have any tripping hazards at SURF right now. You know, when it comes to keeping everything going, there's so much, lab space. There's so much tunnel in SURF. What is that process like, making sure that every nut and bolt is accounted for and making sure that this is a good, safe work environment?
I think it's all about the people, CJ. We have incredible experts on our team. We're constantly doing inspections. We're constantly doing follow-up. And so we act on things as we see them. We try to be proactive. We are in an old facility. And so infrastructure and infrastructure improvements are a big part of how we operate the facility and how we keep it safe. We have to supply, obviously, you know, ventilation, transportation to and from the underground. We have crews that you will never see that are in the very dark corners that are rock bolting. They're providing ventilation. Their water management is another big area that we focus on to make sure that the laboratory spaces are safe for people to come and occupy.
So we're just about out of time for our segment, but the last question that I put to you is that this place is, I don't know, a little mysterious, and that's kind of part of the fun of it. But also, what should South Dakotans know about this fascinating state-of-the-art lab that's right under their backyards?
This place is on the world stage. The work we're doing, it includes scientists from 30 different countries. There are people all over the world who know about SURF and that are coming here to do work on. And we've got an amazing team, as Wendy points out. A lot of them are from South Dakota. A number of, like, our engineers got an education here, had to go away because they couldn't find a job here, and came back, and now they're doing great work and being able to raise a family right here in the state. And so I think people need to know we've got a great team. We're doing work that's on the world stage. It's not spooky or classified. I get that a lot, but it's really trying to advance our fundamental knowledge of the world around us.
It's not quite Area 51.
It's not. It's not. I used to do that kind of work, and this is not that. So.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB News. Mike Headley and Wendy Straub, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
2 in the moment on SDPB Radio. CJ Keen coming to you live from nearly a mile underground at the Sanford Underground Research Facility underneath Pacific League. We're joined next by Dr. Sojanya Galapini. She's working on the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So I just want to give you this opportunity to absolutely go over your work, because the work that you do here is both fascinating and complex. So I'll let you have this opportunity to tell us a little bit about what it is that you're doing.
Mm-hmm. I'm an experimental particle physicist, and there's many particles around us. The particle I'm most interested in is neutrinos, which is pretty apt for this occasion. We're here in South Dakota in lead for the Neutrino Day. So studying these particles to understand how the universe has formed or evolved, and to the basic question that has been haunting the humanity, which is, you know, how did we come into existence? Why are we here? Is something we're after. And in order to study that, we build gigantic detectors. And the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment is one such experiment. In fact, this will be the largest detector of its kind that we'll build ever, that uses liquid argon as the detecting material. So I work on Dune experiment. I work on a number of other experiments that study neutrinos. For example, we have smaller scale experiments at Fermi National Lab in Illinois. I'm part of those as well. Personally, my research, I do a number of things. You know, I developed this instrumentation for calibrating the signals that particles leave in the detector. You know, when a particle comes in, interacts with argon, it leaves signals. And a lot of our science depends on how precise we can get in extracting those signals. So I do R&D and instrumentation to try to extract them. There's other things I do, data analysis. You know, we collect big data with our experiments, so using machine learning tools to analyze the data. So my work spreads over the spectrum of everything that goes into building detectors and then extracting the signals to do the science. One of my big jobs these days is I'm the co-spokesperson of the Dune experiment. So leading the collaboration towards that one goal of building the experiment and ultimately taking data is something that's taking up a lot of my time these days.
Well, I will take up just a little bit of your time, and we appreciate you having the time to sit with us today, because, you know, you're working on big, quick picture questions. And obviously, while that's fascinating, it can also be existential a little bit. What are you feeling when you're looking this deeply and this far out into what the universe is made of?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting with Dune, to study the universe, and to go into the past, we have to look a mile under our feet. One good way to understand Dune is, you know, imagine this is like a time machine built out of science, you know, from sitting underground, and we want to look in the past and see what happened when the universe has formed in those first few seconds. Because that goes to your existential question about how did we come into existence. Neutrinos are important in this scenario because neutrinos are the second most pervasive particles that we have in the universe. They're notorious, though. It's hard to detect them. I'm sure we'll get there when we talk about detectors. But it's these little invisible particles that really give you the window into the science and help us answer these existential questions.
I would like to talk about the detectors, mm-hmm. because they're fascinating machines, but also what is it that the detector is actually showing us when mm-hmm. we are able to see this far down?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you go back, I don't know, few decades ago, we had bubble chambers. Remember, you know, largely made of hydrogen. And what came out of the bubble chambers were these very photographic images. You know, at the time, with the technology that we had, we were literally looking at those images and saying, oh, this looks like a particle came here and it left this tracks. Now, you know, fast forward 30, 40 years now forward, you know, there's so many sophisticated tools that we have. So imagine that the detector technology of Dune is what we call liquid argon time projection chamber. Sounds kind of like time machine, right? And it is as cool as the time machine. This detector, we fill our detectors with some materials. usually in order to make neutrinos, increase the probability of neutrinos interacting within our detector, we tend to fill them with densest materials you can think of. That's not the only factor. There are other things that go in. So with Dune, where we fill our detector with liquid argon. Liquid argon is one of the noble liquids out there, and they come with great properties when it comes to detecting particles. So Dune is like a digitized bubble chamber. So imagine big bulky TVs some time ago. Now we have these really neat flat screen TVs. That's exactly what this is. So what Dune captures is the signals that neutrinos leave. In fact, we have wire chambers for one of our detectors that are as thick as our hair, so not really thick, as thin as our hair, actually, that can capture the signals, the tracks that neutrinos leave. So, in fact, what ultimately comes out of Dune is this very photographic-like images. So it's very much an imaging detector. Only now we have many tools, including machine learning, which are really good at pattern recognition that can look at these images and help us understand what we're actually looking at.
Might I add, you are an excellent science communicator. All of these analogies, they really help me understand what you're going on. I especially like the thought of it being a time machine. But could you take me inside the process of how these machines are built? Because that's a they're fascinating.
They're fascinating. In fact, Dune, like I mentioned before, is unprecedented in scale. So when people ask me, how is it like being on Dune, especially in my role as the co-spokesperson, I say, it's like being on a roller coaster. I'm excited and, you know, it's scary, exciting, and challenging all at the same time. And a lot of that mix of emotions comes from the fact that we are trying to build something that has never been built at this scale before. So, you know, the detector consists of, you know, the size of the detector, maybe that's a good place to start. If you look at the refrigerator that holds liquid argon is a cryogenic liquid, so it's extremely cold. So, we need a refrigerator where we can put our detector, you know, put the liquid argon in. So that cryostat is almost 7 stories tall. And then the length of it probably spans 2 football fields. The detector is pretty close too in terms of that dimensions. And you can imagine when you build something at that scale, you can't just build it as one piece. So the detector is heavily segmented. It's made of a number of materials. You have different types of plastics we use. We use steel to build that cryostat, the refrigerator that I'm talking about. In fact, we're moving these really large, really long beams of that cryostat. It's in beautiful red color. It's basically steel. We're now moving them, and we'll start assembling them in a couple of months. So all these pieces need to really come together in order to build this detector. And there is when we study particles, we detect what we call charge, you know, positive, negative, many are familiar with. But neutrinos interactions also result in light. A lot of the times we can't really see the light, so we have to build specialized detectors that can see that light. So we have the two types of detectors that detect charge, that detect light. We have cathode, anode, the plus and the minus, and then we have liquid argon. So all these pieces need to come together to build this. Yeah.
So the last question that I have for you before we jump to our next guest is, your work at Dune, how has it changed your perspective on our place in the universe? Or has it?
It has certainly changed my perspective. So I switched to doing neutrinos roughly 10, 12 years ago. So my thesis was not on neutrinos. I was studying different particles. And that tells you already that this field has really intrigued me. As scientists, we are attracted to oddities in nature, and neutrinos sit at the top of that list. They're not sociable, although they're very pervasive. There's a number of experiments around the world now trying to study neutrinos. You know, it's exactly like the largest puzzle piece you can think of. You know, neutrinos were very first predicted in 1931, and now we're almost a century later, there's still a lot we don't know. And the beauty to me is the, you know, the studying neutrinos, you know, automatically you're studying about the universe because they affect and influence and impact the universe at that level. It did change my perspective. I think, I would say whenever I go down a mile underground, it's a humbling experience because one person can't build this. The world has really come together to build the Dune experiment. We are now more than 1,500 collaborators spanning more than 38 countries in the world. And I would not have imagined collaborating with some countries if I were not in this experiment. You know, we have collaborators from Madagascar. We have collaborators from Paraguay. We have collaborators from India, South Korea, you name it, you know, number of countries and institutes. And that's a very humbling experience. You know, it has taken the world to come together to understand and really pin down on that existential question of why we're here. Of course, Dune will do a lot more than that. You know, we'll see neutrinos from sun, we'll see neutrinos, stars explode, stars form, black holes, neutron star. Think about anything big happening in the cosmos. Neutrinos are the particles that are messengers for this. And given the scale of Dune is really capable to study all those interesting signals that come out. So it's humbling, it's adventurous. I'm really excited, actually. We are right at the cusp of building the detector underground in a couple of months, and the collaboration, the global collaboration will come together to make it happen. So more exciting news.
It's not just our place in the universe, it's our place among humanity.
Humanity, yeah, exactly.
Dr. Sujanya Galapini, thank you so much for joining us and discussing your work at Dune. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We're going to move on next to Rachel Berg. She's the SURF 2026 Artist in Residence. Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I want to ask you about this because I think you'll have an interesting take on the adventure that it takes just to get underground. How's the journey for you?
Oh, wow. It has been such an exciting testing kind of revealing journey. First of all, just all of the, a lot of the what I am doing here and what I'm interested in about this place is so layered, and there is no better metaphor than kind of going down into the earth and seeing all of these layers of earth and then getting to this space that, you know, at one time was a mine, just, you know, they're just the level of dirt, and then going into a lab where you are, it's the level of precision and cleanness. This kind of building a ship in a bottle is a really amazing analogy for that. And the seeing the layers, again, a reference to time, like seeing the layers of time that are required and the history of not only the whole history of Hisapa in the Black Hills and the specialness of this particular place, but traveling down and really being in the heart of the mountain and the heart of stone to seek our creation is just, it's really an adventure. It's the biggest one I've ever been on.
Yeah, so now that you're experiencing this firsthand, how are you approaching your role in the SURF space?
Oh, so it has been such, I have never had more ideas as an artist as I've had during this experience. The approach, so I kind of am always very, very interested in the intersection between different disciplines and the human experience and the way that we seek knowledge, the way that we practice things in our lives that give us knowledge and pass knowledge on to the next generation. And so that's a very intriguing thing about being here. And my approach is really extremely layered. I mean, I think I came here with some ideas. I'm very interested in Lakota creation stories and how those stories and this place and the work that's happening here in at the lab is really interconnected and how those stories are layered. But the more I'm here, the more I just really want to tell the story of the people and the work and the way that throughout history, there are certain circumstances that have made it possible to seek these questions here in this place. So I think there's a big, I'm doing a lot with material. All of this matter, dark matter, neutrinos, light, darkness, all of these very universal fundamental things that are very much a part of the human experience, it's becoming material is becoming very important in my process. And I hope to be telling the story of some of the experiments. I've become very fascinated with the data and the way that the data looks and the way that one can understand what's happening and how this data really is a doorway into new understandings. So I think I'm gonna do a lot with the data and making it experiential for the viewer so that you can maybe understand a little bit of the way that it feels down here, of the way that it, of the way that the scientists are able to look at that and make understanding. So I want to kind of bridge that and make it possible for people that don't get this experience or don't necessarily have that background.
So you're starting to get to the next question that I want to ask you, and that is, and again, I'm not going to ask you to spoil your whole plan for your time here, but also, you know, there is a huge range of things that happen here, both in terms of the scientific and the physical and the metaphysical. Mm-hmm. So when you're trying to think of how you can communicate everything that is happening through your work, I guess with yourself, what is that conversation like?
So it's been really, again, eye-opening, expansive, and interesting, and easier than I thought it would be, because I've always kind of approached art making with a kind of scientific methodology. Like I kind of will create rules for myself and then explore those rules and kind of work out different ways and just kind of with an intuitive sense of knowing this is the right, or this is, you know, this is the way I'm gonna make it. And what's happening and what I'm experiencing, I kind of started with Lakota geometries and Lakota star knowledge and some of the symbols that are taught in star knowledge. And I am seeing so many intersections between those symbols, both what they mean, the philosophy, the teaching, but also the math and the more tangible just geometry, the way that it looks. And to see those intersections is extremely exciting. And also to kind of have this sense that the experiments that are happening here kind of in a lot of ways are proving some of the philosophical contexts for the Lakota people. Like, we're all connected. You know, that notion is the work that's being done here is really presenting that in a scientific way, in a different way. I often feel that science and spirit are kind of, especially this science universe, you know, studying where we came from, the origin, they're kind of two sides of the same coin. It's just different ways of looking at it. And art has a really special way of being able to give experiential information through the material, through the human hand, through the experience of being in spaces with art. So I think that I'm really leaning into those intersections and just allowing myself to be open. I'm even having dreams of equations that are turning into symbols and images. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways that I think my challenge is going to be weeding out I have so many ideas. The challenge is going to be deciding which ones will make the most sense for the project.
Always a challenge separating the wheat from the chaff, especially when you're drowning in ideas. I mean, since you've begun, where is it that you've found that inspiration the most? Has it been walking around? Has it been in the dreams? They just kind of come to you. Where have you found it for the most part?
You know, it's really just keeping my eyes open. It's observation, which again kind of goes back to the scientific process. Really observing the people first and foremost, and listening very closely, and really trying to better understand the science, everything that they're studying and the way that it's being analyzed, but also just the appearance of everything. Like from an art perspective, the engineering and infrastructure that is happening here is so incredible. You know, I'm a maker. They're making. The scale is immense. And so, I mean, I think it's really mostly just looking and then reflecting upon it and just allowing those intersections to rise to the surface or, you know, that's what I mean. It is abundant. There are so many things that are overlapping with visuals. And I'm leaning into that because I think that there's a lot there.
We're just about out of time, and it's so hard for me to be like, oh, really quickly, let's talk about your vision for what you're going to be doing. But, you know, you have this lovely space. You have all of this information. I guess, what are you seeing as you are taking that step into making?
So one direction that I'm really seeing is scale. You know, trying to make both the macro and the micro scale at the same time. You know, things where you can experience. You know, even I might even try to make us the size of neutrinos. You know, what does that feel like? What are these, you know, what are these particles? How are we, how do they live among us? And that's a really interesting question for me, just kind of spatially. And I think playing with scale and playing with just the shapes and forms that we as all humans understand and relate to, and just presenting them in alternative ways that may help us to expand our perspective.
Rachel Berg is the SURF 2026 Artist in Residence. We're very excited to see how your work turns out.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. You're in the moment. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. CJ Keene coming to you from a mile underground in the Sanford Underground Research Facility. We're joined next from the SURF Visitor Center. It's Kelly Berg. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sherry Bornhorst with the Little Shop of Physics.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Happy to have you. I will not sing the Little Shop of Horrors song on air because I will not subject our listeners to that.
I think we all want you to, but if there's time, maybe.
But, you know, are we talking about people eating neutrinos here? Like, what are we seeing in the Little Shop of Physics?
Yeah, well, we're so glad to be back. This is our fourth neutrino day. We had this happy little meeting with the education team up here at SURF a while back, and they invited us, and we're just going to keep coming back as long as we can, because we're such a small town. You guys throw an amazing science festival, and we love being a part of it. So we set up in the parking garage of the hotel there, the Hampton Inn, and which makes a great space for our hands-on science experiments. So we drove a van full of over 100 hands-on science experiments that we will have set up. And we're all about free play and exploration and doing science with all ages of people.
So could you speak to how an event like Neutrino Day and all of the various activities and things that you can do, you know, how does that connect people to the science that happens and how does that create new scientists?
I think that the hands-on activities that places like Little Shop of Physics demonstrates brings people into the science. They may not even necessarily know they're always doing science in the way that they ask questions, the way that they interact. And so those activities really bring people in. They're also working with STEM practitioners, and so it might be a chance to see themselves in science or a STEM field for the first time.
When you're working with the youth, tell me a little bit about what you think creates a scientist who might thrive in an environment like SURF.
Honestly, I think it's curiosity. They just want to know more about the world around them. And I think that's what's so cool about Neutrino Day is it kind of celebrates the science that's happening in all of our backyards. It's the forces that interact with us on a daily basis. It's stuff happening throughout the state and the region. You get to meet all these people who are coming from all over the world right here to lead South Dakota to do groundbreaking science.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think people don't maybe naturally make relationships with big scientific laboratories, right? Can you just show up these places as a normal person? And the same goes, I work at a university. People don't naturally connect with universities. And so I think the role that Little Shop serves and that, like, and we pair with you because you are after that same mission of we're the connection piece between the science and the community, mm-hmm. and bringing those two together so that just the general community can see what science is happening here in the backyard, like you said, which is really big stuff that, you know, not just South Dakota proud, but like nation proud. Like this is really big and over the whole world, and people should know about it. And so, yeah, just making a welcoming environment for people to feel like they can come in and engage with science and scientists.
When you're doing the work that you're doing, could you speak to that value of having that firsthand, maybe even hands-on experience with science?
Yeah, I think we can all think back to an experience we've had with science, and you remember the way it made you feel, right? And sometimes, unfortunately, you didn't have a good experience, but there's also hopefully in there, scattered in there, the good experiences. And I think those good experiences are always filled with wonder. It was an experience you had that you saw something for the first time. And so that's what we're aiming to accomplish always when we set up our hands-on science experiments. We just want to set something in front of people that they've never seen before, that when they walk away, they want to learn more about.
Well, I think one of the fun things about Neutrino Day is that you have everything from that really hands-on, tactile part of a Little Shop of Physics, which is, it's so fun. There's so much energy in that space. But then there's, looking at science through art, and art projects that highlight how we visualize big science or very small science, making that invisible more visible. There's great performances and presentations that also highlight different ways of accessing or kind of coming into the STEM field. And I think that's kind of one of the things that's so fun about Neutrino Day is that there really is something to kind of draw everyone in and create that sense of wonder and awe of like, oh, I never thought that music tied into science and that there's a science behind the way that the sound in music is produced.
So Neutrino Day is just about here. We encourage everybody who can make it to lead to give Neutrino Day a go. I just want to give you the opportunity to maybe speak to what we're about to see.
Oh my goodness, we are taking over the town of Lead to have a huge community-wide festival. Stop by the visitor center starting about 8:30 in the morning to sign up for your hoist room tour. There are hands-on activities throughout the visitor center and then all the way up at the Hampton Inn and the Hanley Center. There are, as I mentioned, hoist room tours all day. We have performances and presentations up at the Ethnobotanical Garden at SURF from 9 to noon. And then all day long in the historic Homestake Opera House, we have an amazing series of speakers, panelists, and presentations, all capped off by South Dakota Public Broadcasting's own Science Steve. So we just encourage everyone to come out. We know it might be a warm day. We have water. We have free liquid nitrogen ice cream. Lots
Which
of places.
Is right next to us at the Little Shop of Physics. We have a prime location, really. But it does take all day to see everything. So that's something I've learned over the last 4 years. You really want to get started early. And me and my team, personally, we take shifts so that each one of us can go out and see all the other excitement that there is throughout the town of Lead.
Liquid nitrogen ice cream. Even your dessert has science in it. That's incredible.
Absolutely.
That is incredible. And also, I was saying, we need to get Science Steve down here. I think that he'd have a ball down here, I think. So when it comes to that next generation of scientists listening to this program right now and I'm sorry your parents are forcing you to listen to public radio, but it's good for you. What would you say that might help them see the beauty in the science that's happening all around us all the time?
I think there's something about the fact that the science happening, it's so accessible. I know that it might feel intimidating when we start talking about dark matter or neutrinos. And I think one of the things that's so fascinating about festivals like Neutrino Day, the work that Little Shop of Physics does, is it shows us, again, the way that science interacts with us daily, whether we necessarily see it or not. And it helps make that visible and then something that you kind of continue to be curious and wonder about. And I think that I want everyone to come and experience that for themselves.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I truly believe that everybody is a scientist, because back to what you were saying earlier about curiosity, I think something that unites all humans is that we're all curious about something. And allowing ourselves, even as adults, to play is so important, to be curious about things and give ourselves the time to play and explore and learn new things. I think a common misunderstanding is that people view science as something that happens in fancy laboratories that they're not a part of. But the truth is, science is happening every time you ask a question of, I wonder what would happen if I did this. So every time you're wondering about something and then you go trying to investigate it, you are a scientist. You are thinking as a scientist. And so for people to see science in that way, that it's a mindset, it's a verb, it's something we do. It's not a collection of facts that, you know, maybe you don't have memorized.
I think there's something so wonderful in all of our Neutrino Day booths and the people who come, that they inspire that wonder and curiosity. They're so interactive, and you're asking questions and encouraging everyone who comes to ask questions of you. If everyone's getting ready to come to Neutrino Day tomorrow, come ready with your questions and ask those as you're at each of the booths. Everyone can't wait to visit.
That is Kelly Kirk with the Surf Visitor Center and Sherry Bornhorst with the Little Shop of Physics. You can meet both of them at Neutrino Day this weekend. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.